Explicit content is found in this episode, so listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. I first heard of Eddie Lee Sexton and the crimes he committed about 15 years ago. I was browsing through my mom's vast true crime collection and happened upon House of Secrets by Lowell Caulfield. Now, if this is the first time you've heard the name Eddie Lee Sexton, I definitely would recommend picking up that book after listening to this episode. Part 1 of this episode will provide a foundation into the early years of Eddie Lee Sexton and his family. Part 2 will address the murders in which some of the Sextons were found guilty of. Okay, on to the show. Eddie Lee Sexton was born on May 12, 1942 in Pike County, Virginia. The youngest of 10 children, he would begin exhibiting what some would say are the classic signs of a psychopath. He began experimenting with arson and animal torture. His father was a Baptist preacher and his mother was a homemaker who often coddled her youngest son. His siblings would state that while they did chores, Eddie would sit on his mother's lap and read a book. His father passed away when Eddie was 10, and a few years after his death, his mother would be debilitated by a stroke. His siblings would begin to work to assist with the care of their mother, and Eddie Lee's mother, Lana, would ensure that her youngest son never lifted a finger. His older brother, Otis, would later relay, "Eddie Lee never had to pick coal. Man, he was a mama's boy all the way." Ever remaining a mama's boy, Eddie Lee would mature only in age. His oldest brother joined the Navy, and Eddie soon followed suit, but decided to join the Army. Eddie Lee did not have a successful Army career. In fact, he would be released after 6 months due to bad conduct. After his release in 1962, Eddie Lee would be sentenced to 5 years in prison for armed robbery, in which he beat a gas station attendant with a tire iron. After his release, his psychopathy would continue to escalate, and the religious upbringing he had as a child would provide the foundation for Eddie's own church. He would not lead his flock to heaven. He would lead his flock to sin. In 1967, he would meet his wife Estella May through a mutual friend. Estella had a child through a previous relationship, though she never married that child's father. Eddie and Estella's courtship would last about a year until they wed. After they married, they would move to Canton, Ohio, where they would begin their family. They would have 12 children in total, with the oldest being born in 1969. Eddie Lee was known to dislike hard work. His mother never required it of him, and Eddie did not have the desire to contribute to his household. He realized that by faking a disability, the government would provide for him and his family. In 1970, while employed with Canton Drop Forge, Eddie would claim to suffer a back injury. He was awarded workers' compensation, and a government disability benefit soon followed. In order to ensure his ruse continued, Eddie would purchase a wheelchair and a hospital bed. He would claim he was also blind and suffered from multiple sclerosis. Whenever caseworkers came to visit Eddie Lee, he would either be seen in his wheelchair or hospital bed. However, the government benefits were not enough for him. He would also begin to set fire to the family home and other homes over the years, even while his children were inside, just to claim the insurance money. Eddie received his mail order license to become a preacher in 1971. He would change scripture and make claims that Lucifer was not the only angel cast out of heaven, that God had also cast out other angels, and they came to earth and married among men. This rhetoric encouraged his congregants to believe that men too could be gods. The congregation consisted of Eddie Lee's family and a few friends. The church would only remain active for 6 months, He practiced a blend of Satanism and Pentecostalism and claimed that they were descendants from the angels who came and married amongst men, also known as the Futurtrons. Eddie Lee found that the only people he truly had control over was his family. This control would eventually cause some members of his family, including Eddie, to commit some heinous acts. Eddie Lee's 12 children would begin experiencing abuse at the hands of their father early on in life. The family mantra for punishment became, "Until 16, you get the belt. After that, you get the fist." He would beat his children on a daily basis and be joined by his wife. However, she was not spared from his abuse. On one occasion, after locking his daughter inside of a closet, Eddie sprayed roach spray under the door. After his daughter passed out, he left. Estella pulled her from the closet. When Eddie returned and saw this, he threw the girl back inside the closet and proceeded to beat Estella May. The children would witness their father beat their mother on several occasions and recall an instance where he held a loaded shotgun to her head. In fact, he would do this multiple times with different children and demand secrecy and family loyalty from them.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
Eddie Lee introduced satanic rituals to his children. One story of a hooded Eddie Lee conducting a ritual consisted of gathering the children around a dead cat as everyone held hands. He told them that spirits needed a sacrifice in order to come to him. Animals would not be the only sacrifices offered to his Futurtrons. He would also use the miscarried fetuses from his wife to perform these rituals on. His son Christopher and daughter Sherry testified that their father had taken a fetus that their mother had miscarried in 1987, chopped it up, and boiled it for his family to consume. After the dinner, they conducted a séance where their father would call the spirit out of the child and ask it to speak to his living children. Unfortunately, the abuse would only intensify for his children. At early ages, Eddie Lee and Estella May would force their children to perform sexual acts on them and on their other siblings. At the age of 6, his son James was ordered to perform fellatio on his father. Once that was complete, love and belly activity time would begin, and Eddie Lee would draw a smiley face on his stomach and force his son to suck on it. He even offered his sons $1 if they fondled and sucked on their mother's breast. Estella May was completely complicit. The son known as Skipper would create the Statue of Liberty game. This game would consist of Skipper standing like the Statue of Liberty and asking his younger sister Kimberly and his younger sister Lana to perform fellatio on him. When Christopher, another one of Eddie's sons, told his father what he had witnessed, he and his wife beat and whipped Skipper until he bled. His mother would claw at his neck and pull his hair, while his father whipped him with his belt. A total of 49 lashes were counted by the children, who huddled by the door to listen to the beating. Eddie Lee would only approve of the abuse if he ordered it. If one of his sons went behind his back to molest their sister, he would beat them. Lana was especially off limits, because she was Dad's angel. Skipper would also perpetrate crimes upon his brothers and sisters. He would sodomize his brothers and request fellatio from his sisters. Eddie Lee would sodomize his sons on occasion, and his wife would fondle their penises and perform fellatio. Skipper would deny these allegations. When his daughter Sherry turned 17, she was forced to participate in a satanic wedding ceremony where the groom was her own father. She recalled wearing a veil, a garter, and seeing her father in a suit. They would exchange a kiss, after reading the vows from the Satanic Bible. Once pictures of the ceremony were taken, her father would lead her upstairs to his master bedroom for the honeymoon. Eddie Lee would participate in these wedding ceremonies with each of his daughters. His daughter Kimberly, who was 12 at the time when she married her father, would recount how she was molested on several occasions by her mother and father when she slept with them in their master bedroom. She stated that she was French kissed during her own wedding ceremony. His daughter Shelley testified that her mother had rubbed her breast during a fake breast exam and sodomized her with her fingers to check for worms. She too would marry her father at the age of 13. Eddie's favorite daughter was Estella, or Pixie as she was nicknamed by her father. She too was subjected to the same abuse by her mother and father, but her father had molded her to be more complicit than his other daughters. She would tell her father everything. She would also meet him in the family basement for sex. The sexual acts were witnessed by more than one of the Sexton children and would later be recounted in court testimony. She would eventually give birth to two young daughters, Dawn, born in 1988, and Shasta, born in 1990. These children were the grandchildren and children of Eddie Lee Sexton. He would come to father another child with his daughter Sherry, a boy named Christopher. He would tell his children that, quote, "It's all within the law. It's natural." Christopher Sexton was labeled the favorite son. He was afforded more opportunities to be a normal kid, at least on the surface. He was permitted by his father to participate in athletic activities, particularly football. He was allowed to date girls and make phone calls to a small number of friends. This freedom came with a price. When Eddie Lee felt like sodomizing Christopher, he would walk around the house and state, "Tonight, I'm getting some butt," or, "It's time for me to get some butt." Those words would indicate to Christopher that he would need to follow his father upstairs to his master bedroom. His mother had also violated Christopher. Despite being an athlete, he was expected to bend to the will of his mother. He was fondled and given oral sex by his mother. She engaged in sexual intercourse with him, and when questioned later, Christopher would deny it occurred often, and that his father had stopped sexually abusing him in his late teens. To say that Estella May was a victim would be to disregard how she harmed her children. Yes, she was beaten by Eddie Lee, but she had assisted him in committing brutal acts against her children. She would partake in shaving their daughter's pubic hair and force them to come cuddle with her in bed after they had taken a shower and were completely nude. She would fondle them and penetrate them with her fingers, and then she would ask them to do the same. She would later deny that she was a willing accomplice, but all of her children would blame her in part for how they were treated. If you're wondering if the abuse was ever investigated during this time, it was. There were questions surrounding Pixie's pregnancy, since she and the rest of her siblings were forbidden to go anywhere but home and school. They were warned against speaking to anyone outside of the family, including neighbors, and made to follow their father's every word. Some wondered how Pixie could manage to even get pregnant. Not once, but twice. When she was questioned about the whereabouts of the children's father, she stated that the last she heard, he had moved to Mexico, and she did not know where he was currently. DHS eventually determined that they could not prove abuse was occurring in the household. Each child that was interviewed corroborated Pixie's story about the man who went to Mexico. Eddie became hypervigilant after the DHS investigation concluded. He required each of his family members to keep a journal of their daily activities, and each day he would give them a quarter, so that if they witnessed their siblings speaking to an authority figure, a DHS worker, a policeman, a principal, they would need to run to the nearest payphone and call their father immediately to report what they had seen. his children could not make a move without Eddie knowing about it. However, this facade would begin to crack when one child finally spoke up. Shelley Sexton sat in her counselor's office and stated that she was pregnant and that her father and brothers were attempting to kill the baby. She described how her younger brother James caught her kissing her boyfriend one day after school. He ran home and told their father. When she arrived home, her father had attacked her by slapping her in the face, and James attempted to kick her in the stomach. She said that James had previously done the same thing to Sherry when he found out that she was pregnant. The kick had caused Sherry to miscarry. Shelley would later be told that she was not pregnant. Eddie was aware that he was being investigated by DHS. Wanting to distract attention away from the fact that he had fathered both Dawn and Shasta, he told Pixie to begin dating Joel Good Jr., a high school classmate. She would periodically visit his house, and his aunt had noticed that she was always standing behind Joel, as if to hide herself, and she barely spoke. She would go on dates with Joel, but seemed disinterested when he made advances towards her. They even went to senior prom, at the behest of Eddie Lee. You see, Eddie Lee had a plan. He would encourage Pixie to marry Joel Good, have him adopt the two girls, and move into the house, where he could remain in control of their life. In 1992, amidst the statements that Shelley was given to the authorities, they wed, and despite the occasion, Pixie would refuse to consummate her marriage. However, Eddie Lee's plan worked. Joel Good adopted the girls. And as time passed, he became keenly aware that his new father-in-law was more than just a dad to Pixie. The tales of abuse that Shelley would share with caseworkers and detectives would cause a judge to order that the youngest children be placed in the custody of the state. When Estella May was to return to court and request custody be returned back to her, she was a no-show. Later, DHS would receive word that the children were missing from their foster homes. Eddie Lee Sexton, with the assistance of his wife and older children, would round up his younger children one by one. Investigators had no idea how strong his hold was on his family. If they did, they would have handled the events that occurred on November 21st very differently. On November 21st, 1992, he phoned into Channel 5, a Cleveland news station. He told the assignment editor that he was being harassed by DHS and the allegations made by them were bogus. He stated that he had barricaded his home and was armed and would kill any worker or police that pulled up into his driveway. The standoff was televised on Channel 5 and would eventually end when the judge in the case agreed to have the caseworker removed. She also promised not to remove any of the children at the time. Eddie Lee agreed to the terms and was arrested without further issue. He would be released after posting $7,500 in bail. The judge would later state that this was one of the biggest mistakes she made, because after Eddie Lee made bond, he gathered up his remaining children and fled the state of Ohio. Join us next time for the continuation of America's Most Dysfunctional Family. We're going to follow the Sextons down to Florida, and I'll reveal the nature of their crimes. Trust me, it's not going to be easy, so prepare yourself. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. While you're there, give us a rate and review. It would really be helping us out. You can follow us on social media, facebook.com/TCFC podcast, Twitter at TCFCpod. Our website is truecrimefanclub.com. And if you have future episode suggestions, you can shoot them to us on Facebook or Twitter, or even email us, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Until next time.